Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Let me start by saying why we cut today and then move to 2025. So I would say today was a closer call, but we decided it was the right call because we thought it was the best decision to foster achievement of both of our goals, maximum employment and price stability.
Following a rate cut by the Federal Reserve, Chairman Jerome Powell.
We see the risks as two-sided, moving too slowly and needlessly undermine economic activity in the labor market, or move too quickly and needlessly undermine our progress on inflation. So we're trying to steer between those two risks. And on balance, we decided to go ahead with a further cut. And I'll give you some details on why. Downside risks to the labor market do appear to have diminished, but the labor market is now looser than pre-pandemic, and it's clearly still cooling further, so far in a gradual and orderly way.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
My colleagues and I remain squarely focused on achieving our dual mandate goals of maximum employment and stable prices for the benefit of the American people. The economy is strong overall and has made significant progress toward our goals over the past 2 years.
Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, on Wednesday announcing another rate cut.
The labor market has cooled from its formerly overheated state and remains solid. Inflation has moved much closer to our 2% longer run goal. We're committed to maintaining our economy's strength by supporting maximum employment and returning inflation to our 2% goal. To that end, today, the Federal Open Market Committee decided to take another step in reducing the degree of policy restraint by lowering our policy interest rate by a quarter percentage point. We also decided to continue to reduce our securities holdings. I'll have more to say about monetary policy after briefly reviewing economic developments. Recent indicators suggest that economic activity has continued to expand at a solid pace. GDP rose at an annual rate of 2.8% in the third quarter, about the same pace as in the second quarter. Growth of consumer spending has remained resilient, and investment in equipment and intangibles has strengthened. In contrast, activity in the housing sector has been weak. Overall, improving supply conditions have supported the strong performance of the U.S. economy over the past year. In our summary of economic projections, committee participants generally expect GDP growth to remain solid, with a median projection of about 2% over the next few years. In the labor market, conditions remain solid. Payroll job gains have slowed from earlier in the year, averaging 173,000 per month over the past 3 months. The unemployment rate is higher than it was a year ago, but at 4.2% in November, it has remained low. Nominal wage growth has eased over the past year, and the jobs-to-workers gap has narrowed. Overall, a broad set of indicators suggests that conditions in the labor market are now less tight than in 2019. The labor market is not a source of significant inflationary pressures. The median projection for the unemployment rate in the SEP is 4.2% at the end of this year and 4.3% over the next few years. Inflation has eased significantly over the past 2 years, but remains somewhat elevated relative to our 2% longer-run goal. Estimates based on the Consumer Price Index and other data indicate that total PCE prices rose 2.5% over the 12 months ending in November, and that, excluding the volatile food and energy categories, core PCE prices rose 2.8%. Longer-term inflation expectations appear to remain well-anchored, as reflected in a broad range of surveys of households, businesses, and forecasters, as well as measures from financial markets. The median projection in the SEP for total PCE inflation is 2.4% this year and 2.5% next year, somewhat higher than projected in September. Thereafter, the median projection falls to our 2% objective. Our monetary policy actions are guided by our dual mandate to promote maximum employment and stable prices for the American people. We see the risks to achieving our employment and inflation goals as being roughly in balance, and we are attentive to the risks on both sides of our mandate. At today's meeting, the committee decided to lower the target range for the federal funds rate by a quarter percentage point to 4.25% to 4.5%. We've been moving policy toward a more neutral setting in order to maintain the strength of the economy and the labor market, while enabling further progress on inflation. With today's action, we have lowered our policy rate by a full percentage point from its peak, and our policy stance is now significantly less restrictive.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
There's a lot of talk going on right now about what's been referred to as Doge.
Chip Roy is a member of the House of Representatives from Texas.
This effort by our friends Elon and Vivek with respect to the Department of Government Efficiency. Not 100% clear yet what that looks like in terms of formality, how the president, incoming president, President Trump, plans to establish it, set it up. We had some great meetings today with those two men and members of Congress who are interested in facilitating their work. And my only problem with the name Department of Government Efficiency is I would prefer it to be the Department of Government Elimination. I think we'd be a lot better off if we were eliminating large swaths of that which has been unconstitutionally created to rack up $36 trillion of debt. But I think what it merits observation is what this body needs to do to actually deliver on what people are, I think, to some degree across the country, getting excited about with respect to the prospect of the brain power that's been assembled around this department, DOGE, or this effort, that Congress has to actually do our part. We had a meeting today, and there was a lot of conversation back and forth, and there was a whole lot of members of Congress who were looking to them to say, please do this. You know, one member said, you know, please help give us the fortitude, the spine, to be able to deliver on removing and cutting this waste in government. Now, look, to be very clear, the use of technology, crowdsourcing, AI by these guys, other smart people around the country, the use of technology, observe it, figure out what to do with it, great. I'm for it. And I support their efforts. I support efforts by the incoming president, his staff, his administration, to, frankly, massively slash and burn the bureaucracy that is sucking away, frankly, the life of the American people through overregulation, overspending, and driving up inflation because we keep spending more and more money in this vast bureaucracy that you can't even keep up with. I have a bill that I introduced a few years ago, Count the Crimes. You know why? Nobody can tell me how many crimes there are. Literally, nobody can tell me how many crimes there are in the federal government. Does anybody see that as a problem? We literally don't even know how many. Forget, you know, cataloging them all, organizing them all, figuring out how much of them are repeated or overburdensome or perhaps out of line. We don't even know. And I can't even get that bill through the committee and down to the floor. What, members of the body don't want to know how many crimes there are so we can maybe go observe and try to do something about it? And on this score is where I believe Elon and Vivek can add massive value. They don't necessarily need us to pass something to go count the crimes. They can just use technology, AI, crowdsourcing, work, and put a whole lot of effort into doing that. Because frankly, a lot of people don't understand this. We're pretty short-staffed here as it relates to our offices on Capitol Hill, dealing with constituent services, dealing with the stuff we deal with all the time. So having an army of people and being able to leverage that is going to be really important. But now let's cut to the chase. The fact of the matter is, too many members of the United States Congress are all too excited to hide behind Elon and Vivek to do the work they're supposed to do. That's the truth. I saw colleagues going to the mic, thanking them. Oh, please save us from the scourge of bureaucracy. Well, what the hell is our job?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Arguably, as an industry, we don't spend as much time as we should focusing on water, but it is the most important nutrient.
Dr. Jason Smith is a Texas A&M AgriLife Extension beef cattle specialist.
It is not uncommon for there to be issues related to water quality. We often think about water quantity, but not as much about water quality. And especially in situations where our surface waters or our dirt tanks, if they've dropped down in level, whether it's because they've been drank or they've dehydrated because of drought, what we often see is this concentration of the things other than water in there. And in certain situations, those can become problematic for cattle. And so I do recommend, whether it's we're turning into a pasture for the first time in a while or we're going to be potentially using a new water source, recommend some water analysis to first and foremost ensure that it's safe for cattle to drink. And then if not, working with somebody to troubleshoot what the options might be to alleviate the issue or find out or identify that that is an unsuitable water source for the animal.
If you're dealing with a drought, Smith also says there are concerns with feeding through drought.
Certain species are sensitive to some of those kinds of stressors. So if particularly if we're going to be feeding a warm season annual, so whether that's sorghum, sedan grass, a hybrid of those, Johnson grass, we are going to have some nitrate and prussic acid risk. That doesn't mean that all those forages are going to be a problem. Likely the majority of them will not be. But we really don't have a good indicator of their risk if we don't test them. And so I want to recommend that if, say, for example, if we're going to be feeding a hay that's of a sorghum variety, we test that for nitrates and prussic acid to ensure that, to try to prevent an issue before it becomes one. This is not, I want to be clear in saying this isn't a reason to avoid those forages, incredibly valuable and useful forages for us here, especially in this part of the world. But those are just risks that we need to be mindful of and manage them. Testing is a starting point for most of us in doing that. We also need to be mindful of some of our grazed forages and in situations where maybe we're grazing a forage that's been grown on some ground that's received some really heavy nitrogen fertilization. There's certain conditions that are going to favor the development of or the accumulation of nitrates that may or may not be problematic. And so we just need to be mindful of those things, especially some of our weed species. If we look at grazing out crop fields, whether it's residue or it's a droughted outcrop or something like that, a lot of our weeds that we say are toxic weeds, many of them are toxic because they're nitrate accumulators. And so we just need to be mindful of those risks and then manage them.
And he says education pays off.
The feedback has been incredibly positive. The average producer that's gone through the Texas BQA program has rated the program favorably in terms of the information that they've got, the knowledge that they receive from participating in it. But they've also, on average, expected financial benefit directly to their operation from information gained from the program, because we spend a lot of time focusing on best management practices, things that influence quality and beef safety, but also impact the efficacy of what we do. Vaccine handling is an example of that. But do things to directly impact the operation through either increasing productivity or decreasing cost of production. So the feedback we've gotten has been that, one, it's a free program. As far as I know, the foreseeable future, it will continue to be a free program that is expected to put money back in producers' pockets.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We carefully assessed it. We can't do all of it right now, but I think what you'll see reflected in this final package is of $10 billion, okay, to start that.
Speaker of the House Mike Johnson on a continuing resolution with disaster aid for ag.
In addition to that, the USDA moved some things around, and they've added $2 billion for specialty crops that they announced in late November. So help is on the way. And I've talked in the last 24, 48 hours to a number of the leaders in the ag community who say they are greatly relieved by that. They understand it's not everything, but it is something to bridge that gap and allow the lenders and the creditors to help those who are preparing to put the crops, plant the crops in the spring. The timeline, the sequence of events is important, and we think we're giving them a big boost of relief at exactly the right time, in the nick of time, frankly. So it's there's always more to do. There's always more to do. But I think this is an important step for Congress. I think the people involved understand that, and it sends a signal to lenders and creditors that Congress will not abandon our food producers, right? Here's the thing. If you have small family farms and ranches that go out of business or they can't make it one more year and they can't get a loan to do it, they're gone. You know, the kids move to the cities and there is no more family farm. You might have noticed very few people start family farms. These are third, fourth, sometimes fifth generation operations. You have to have them. You have to have diversification in the food supply. You have to have producers so that we have fruits and vegetables and nuts and all the things that we need that farmers and ranchers provide to America. We cannot rely on other countries for our food supply. The food supply is directly related to national security. So all these things are being factored in. Congress is doing the very best it can under difficult circumstances, and I think that'll be a big boost to the industry.
After blowback from Republicans, the deal apparently scrapped. Hakeem Jeffries is House Minority Leader.
House Republicans, House Democrats, Senate Republicans, and Senate Democrats reached a bipartisan agreement to fund the government, keep it open, and meet the needs of the American people. We reached a bipartisan agreement to provide disaster assistance to everyday Americans whose lives have been upended and turned upside down as a result of hurricanes, tornadoes, wildfires, floods, and other types of extreme weather events. We reached a bipartisan agreement to meet the needs of the American people and provide assistance to farmers, families, children, seniors, veterans, men and women in uniform, and working class Americans. House Republicans have now unilaterally decided to break a bipartisan agreement that they made. House Republicans have been ordered to shut down the government and hurt everyday Americans all across this country. House Republicans will now own any harm that is visited upon the American people that results from a government shutdown or worse. An agreement is an agreement. It was bipartisan, and there was nothing more to say.
Florida Senator Rick Scott is frustrated.
Over 1,500 pages, all right? The bills had never seen the light of day. None of us knew what was in them. People are expected to vote on very quickly. More regulation. I mean, just wasteful spending. No pay-fors, right? It makes no sense. This is we won the election. This has got to change.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
What they have noticed is that as this debt grows, then more of their taxpayer dollars are being spent to pay the interest on the debt. That is money that is not going to national security. It is money that is not going to disaster relief. It is going to the debt.
Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn.
And here's a great example of that. In just the first half of fiscal year 2024, our country spent, get this, $440 billion to service the debt. Now, interestingly enough, that was more than what we spent on our military in the same time. So the American people are smart. They're seeing this, and they're saying it is a problem, and this has got to be brought under control. Now, I think it's important for us to look at how we've gotten to where we were. And, Madam President, I went back and looked at where we were when George W. Bush left office and President Obama came into office. As George W. Bush left, our debt was at $10.6 trillion. And we all remember that. We remember 2008, 2009. That is not that long ago. But think about that number, $10.6 trillion. Now, I will remind everybody, that was after the Gulf War. That was after that period of time, 9/11, when our economy shut down for a full quarter. And the total debt at that point was $10.6 trillion. Now, when Obama left office, after 8 years in office, that debt had nearly doubled. It was just shy of $20 trillion. Think about that. Now, President Trump came into office. 4 years later, he leaves, and our debt was north of $27 trillion with all the COVID spending that was done in 2020. And instead of restoring spending to stable levels and going back to those pre-COVID levels, what did President Biden do? Since his inauguration, he had piled more than $8 trillion on our debt, and the deficit for this year alone, fiscal 2024 alone, is at $1.8 trillion. And these are the numbers. Anyone that wants to look at this can go to any number of government websites. You can pull up these numbers through OMB, through Treasury. But what the American people have seen is a recklessness and a disregard for them, the taxpayer.
Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn, it's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
NASDA, as we call it, is a 108-year-old association based in Washington, and we represent the state secretaries, commissioners, and directors. Three titles, basically the same job. They lead the ag departments in the state, and they are our members, and by extension, the departments as a whole are as well.
National Association of State Departments of Ag, CEO Ted McKinney, former Undersecretary for Trade at USDA.
Trade can be very complex, and let's just start with saying a lot of countries around the world are very protectionist. They find ways, sometimes legal, sometimes illegal, to protect their own producers, and we get that. We have elements of that as well. Now, I hope we are subscribing to the World Trade Organization rules. We are a rules-based, law-based country, but it happens. So if you start there, you understand it can be very difficult. I would say that, as was the case when I was at Mr. Trump's organization, we found ways to enhance trade. It was bit by bit. The USMCA was an incredible makeover that I think largely has been wildly successful. Dairy with Canada is a big issue that we're still working on, and I know the administration is still working on. We've got corn decree with our good friends with Mexico. Go figure what that's about. So we've got to worry about that. But that said, every administration, and this is no different, Team Biden has been no different, have done the very, very best at bringing along trade where they can. They've opened up some things in India. They've opened up some things in Indonesia. There was a trade deal, minor one, done with Japan. All of that helps the farmer and the rancher and the processor and everybody in between. That said, no matter the political tie, I think we've got to go even further, because right now it's a lot of issues on tariffs. We have higher tariffs on us than many other countries. But I think we can get there no matter who is elected. I think we can get there in time. Right now, I think they're doing what they can, and we'll take what we get.
Rules-based trade is only as good as enforcement. Right now, the World Trade Organization dysfunctional.
It's going to be a slow, difficult slog. Scientific word there. There's no doubt in my book that the World Trade Organization appellate body was not fair to the U.S. and, for that matter, a lot of other OECD, or I'll say wealthier countries. Fair is fair. The facts are the facts. And the appellate body was making a lot of judgments that weren't based on fact, in my opinion. So I support Bob Lighthizer as the U.S. trade rep at the time for getting us out of that. Well, now we're in that slow slog in reconstituting it, and I do think the WTO is essential. We've got to remake it. But in the meantime, absent that, it's bilaterals, meaning one country to another. The days of multilateral are going to be difficult. You know, the other thing is, when we stepped out of the TPP, which was Southeast Asia, that was a very, very good opportunity for us in the U.S. in agriculture. The error was in autos. Gaping hole with autos that would have really hurt significantly the U.S. auto market, which is a big market for the U.S. So though selfishly I'd love to have seen it go through for the sake of agriculture, it would have not been good for the U.S. as a whole. And I'll just say, I've talked to members of Congress, D's and R's, and both were saying it's dead on arrival. So that's why there was the pullout. let's go remake it in some other form.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
One result of the recent announcement of new world screwworm found in some Mexican beef cattle. Live cattle imports into the U.S. restricted. And USDA World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jackanowski says in the context of U.S. beef production forecasts this month and going forward,
for the purpose of our forecasts, we have to assume those restrictions remain in place until they're lifted, and we have no idea when they're going to be lifted.
Leading USDA forecasters to tighten beef supplies for next year, especially the second half of 2025.
Beef production for 2025, we reduced by 620 million pounds, and that would be down about 1.3 or almost 1.4 billion pounds year over year.
Expected tighter supplies also translate into higher prices, a $3 increase for steer prices from the previous month. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.